You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Patrick Dunleavy, a senior fellow at the highly valued Investigative Project on Terrorism. He is the former Deputy Inspector General for the New York State Department of Corrections and author of The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. So, Patrick, we've talked in the previous segment about the nature of the threat, the doctrine animating it, Sharia, I think is the best way to describe it. Talk a little bit about your experiences in the prison system and your insights into what's happening beyond New York State's prison, as this doctrine has been insinuating itself into the various centers where we incarcerate criminals.
Certainly. It's interesting because the title of my book that I grabbed onto was The Fertile Soil of Jihad. And when you think about, if you're going to plant a seed, if you want to grow a crop, the first thing you have to have is good soil. And I think that some of these organizations that we've talked about, particularly the Dar es Salaam movement and others, when they looked in the United States and they said, where's the most profitable soil that we could possibly have to advance our cause, they looked at the prison system. Because where are you going to find individuals that now are at some sort of crisis in their life, may have had a need to change their lives? And so they looked at the prison system and thought, this is where we're going to embark deliberately on a movement to bring individuals to our cause, faith, our form of Islam. So they went and looked at the U.S. prison system, like I said, in the Dar es Salaam movement, and they saw, first of all, that there was a large group of Nation of Islam followers who were primarily African-American inmates. Now, what I saw when I first came into the prison system, one of the first individuals that I actually met who was a Muslim was a guy by the name of Thomas Hagen. Thomas Hagen was in prison for shooting and killing Malcolm X, Malcolm Little. He was a follower of Elijah Muhammad. Now, as the prison mosques began to form, and as they began to change, and as they began to look at bringing in a fundamental Islam, the Nation of Islam changed and became the World Islamic Movement. And Tom Hagen had moved from being a follower of Elijah Muhammad to being a more fundamentalist follower of Islam. And so slowly the mosques in the prisons changed, where they were no longer primarily talking about a Nation of Islam or Black nationalist movement, but they were now talking about Islam as a world religion, as a world movement. And literature started to be coming in and stuff like that. And most of the literature was provided by an organization known as the Graduate Institute of Islamic Sciences and Studies,
Abdurrahman Alamoudi's operation, as I recall. And remind us, if you could, just a little bit about that chap, Abdurrahman Alamoudi, Patrick Dunleavy. This is a guy who had been intimately involved with the Muslim Brotherhood going back to the founding, as I understand it, of the Muslim Students Association, wasn't he?
Right. And his primarily, from what I understood of his primary function, was in getting chaplains established in the same form of Islam to which he and the Muslim Brotherhood prescribed.
In other words, that Salafist, fundamentalist, Sharia supremacist stripe that we were talking about earlier. You know, it's not to minimize the problem that having, Black nationalists would represent in the felon population, but adding into the mix this Sharia supremacist group under the auspices of the Muslim Brotherhood is frankly a nightmare. And as you've watched over the years, Patrick, how widespread is this sort of brotherhood-affiliated chaplaincy in the prison systems these days?
Well, it's predominant. And again, that started from an orchestrated move to first of all, to actually get Muslim chaplains. There was a shortage of them, shall we say, in that there were not found many groups or organizations that provided them. And so organizations like the Muslim Chaplains Association and what Al-Amudi had started were groups that were saying, okay, we can certify individuals, we'll give you chaplains, and they put in the people that they wanted to. And to be quite frank with you, corrections administrators, they were not theologically attuned to, what's the difference between a Shiite and a Sunni? What's the difference between, a Wahhabi or a Salafist? All they knew was get me a chaplain.
Right. And you know what's interesting, Patrick, I think we've talked about this before, but it bears mentioning in this context. I'll never forget, I believe it was in 2004, then Senator John Kyle, who chaired a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee in the United States Senate, looking at terrorism issues, convened a hearing with prison wardens and administrators of the federal correction system. And I think actually some wardens from one or more of the prisons themselves. And to a person, they testified that they were delighted with the work of these chaplains. They didn't call them Muslim Brotherhood chaplains, but that's what they were, because they were turning some of the most hardened and dangerous of the felons in their systems into model prisoners. And I wonder what your thoughts are, based on your experience in the system, as to what the implications of that were.
Well, that's absolutely correct. When you look at a correctional administrator, his goal is, first of all, to make sure that no inmates escape, that there's no assault on staff. They're trying to control contraband. They're given a responsibility of turning individuals around. And they found that the Muslim inmates were the most organized, the most disciplined. Again, I go back to looking at Tommy Hagen. He was the most well-dressed. I mean, every inmate has to wear the same color shirt and everything, but his were clean. They were ironed. His pants were not hanging down around his ankles or anything like that. I mean, disciplined, orderly, yes, sir, no, sir. They were not a disruptive group, say, as the Bloods of the Crips or the Mexican Mafia or any of those other type of prison gangs. And so, of course, correctional officials would be, ecstatic with that. But I have a friend of mine, John Cutter, who was a former deputy chief of the NYPD intelligence division, and we worked on a project looking at radicalization in the prison. And John made an observation. He says the reason that they're so good and well-behaved in prison is because their goal is beyond the walls. And I thought about that, and it made sense to me. Their goal was beyond the walls, not to take over the prison, not to be 1,000 inmates taking over Attica and yelling jihad, jihad. But their goal was to get out of prison and to continue to the goal of a world of Islam. And that was one of the things.
And that's what's so troubling. And I want to come to that in the next segment in some detail with you, because I know that you've been spending a lot of time worrying about that problem of what's happening beyond the walls, Patrick Dunleavy, because indeed, in terms of the warden's concern, it's what's going on inside his system. But it's not his problem, frankly, once those people pass outside those gates, but it sure is the problem for the rest of us. We're going to talk about that and what it might mean for you, for example, with Patrick Dunleavy, the Investigative Project on Terrorism, author of The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. Straight ahead.